The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made it to start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning California time space show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. And we have an interesting program on a topic we haven't talked about for a little bit of time, and that's asteroids. So I'm really looking forward to our discussion with Mr. Dillo in a few minutes. But first, a couple of quick announcements. We're on the 60-minute format, so if you do want to get an email in or a telephone call, please do so in time so that we can address your call or your question while we're still on the air. That would be nice. And do remember that we are a talk show, so talking takes precedence over email. And our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Again, it is the preferred way of communicating with our guests on the Space Show program. You can use email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also post a comment on our blog, which is on our website, thespaceshow.com. If you need instructions on how to use our blog or even how to find it, email me and I'll send them to you very quickly. Don't forget also that we have a website newsletter, and you will see that on the upper right side of our homepage, thespaceshow.com. It will be updated Sunday afternoon after the Sunday Space Show airs. And scroll down on that website newsletter, and it'll show you all the programming we have scheduled so far. And now we're actually booking into the end of the year, and I'm surprised how few dates we have left in October, November, and December. In fact, I'm kind of holding back on booking pending hot stories and new interesting guests that are discovered so we can still get them on during 2019. But that website newsletter will be out Sunday afternoon after the Sunday Space Show ends. And then also note that we have an email newsletter, and that is mailed out every Monday morning about 6 a.m. California time. If you want to get on that email list, please make sure I have your email address. And I will look forward to that. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website very easily, or you can quickly download the shows. We have a store, and if you're interested in Space Show gear, you can find that store by clicking on any of the website pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show. Pepper will guide you to the Cafe Press site for the Space Show. And then Listen Live is a menu item in the upper left menu. And this tells you how to listen to live programs like we're doing this morning. And it tells you how to listen to compressed MP3s that are archived on our website, plus our podcast, including Alexa. So if you have any questions about any of this, it's always best to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Excuse me. Please feel free to share this information with people who may not know about the Space Show or know how to listen to a program on the Space Show. This will help them become members of our Space Show family. To me, always, the funding and support of the Space Show is paramount because that's what enables the Space Show to do its program. And as a listener-supported program, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, which is our parent corporation. And if you are a federal U.S. taxpayer, you get a donation for your gift to the Space Show One Giant Leap Foundation. If you're a California taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift, as we're a California public benefit corporation. You can get a lot more information by going to 1 leapfoundation.org. If you're interested in becoming an advisory board member, there's information there for you under Teams, or just email me and I'll be glad to send it to you. And if you have any questions about what we're doing, fundraising, contributions, let me hear from you. There is also a big PayPal link on our homepage over on the right side for electronic contributions to the show, but it also has detailed information on how to send a check to One Giant Leap if you do not want to do so electronically. And then finally, Amazon has a big button on our homepage, not because we love Amazon, but actually we do. They have great nonprofit supporting programs where they donate a portion of people's purchase prices to the nonprofit of your choice, which we hope you will make the Space Show One Giant Leap Foundation. And they do provide a percentage of whatever people buy to the nonprofit of your choice. So we appreciate Amazon for doing that. And if you're an Amazon user or a regular Amazon user, it's a great way to support the Space Show while carrying on your regular Amazon business. So if you have any questions about that, click on the big Amazon link. It will take you to our Amazon portal at onegiantleap.com, onegiantleapfoundation.org, excuse me, and explain the two Amazon programs that you can use to support the Space Show. And in addition to the individual support, we do have sponsors. And the sponsors get that famous banner ad you see running across our homepage. They can change that ad as often as they want. And I urge you to click on those banner ads because they do change the material underlying those banner ads from time to time. On a full-length show, I read a sponsor message. But on the shorter format shows like today, I simply call out our great sponsors and thank them because we would not be doing the show without them. So I do want to call out Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Moonwards, AIAA, the Space Development Network, Celestis, the National Space Society, and also the Integrated Space Plan, which, remember, it's coming up into the last part of their Kickstarter plan to finance a new Integrated Space Plan for 2019, plus their Race to the Moon poster. And you can find out more about this by going to their website, thespaceplan.com, clicking on their banner ad, which is going across our Space Show site. We're searching for Integrated Space Plan at Kickstarter. And you'll note that the Space Show has a program there, a benefit there for people who want to support their Kickstarter plan. And you get to be a guest on the show. So many of you contact me and are self-invited guests and you want to be on the show, and I never accept you because we have a policy of not accepting self-invited guests to the show. So if you've always wanted to be on the Space Show, this offer to support their Kickstarter plan bypasses our rule of not accepting self-invited guests. So this may be your chance to be a full guest on a Space Show program. So check it out at their Kickstarter place. And again, you can get there by clicking on their banner ad on the Space Show site. We're just going to thespaceplan.com. So our guest today is an author. He's also a veteran newspaper reporter, columnist, as well as a war correspondent. Gordon Dillo has written for a number of publications, including the Los Angeles Times, the Herald Examiner, the Orange County Register, and he has collaborated on many different nonfiction books. But he has a brand new book, and it is Fire in the Sky, Cosmic Collisions, Killer Asteroids, and the Race to Defend Earth. And it's published by Scribner Press, if I'm getting that correctly, and which is part of Simon & Schuster, as I believe. He lives in Arizona, and actually living in Arizona is what gave him his interest in asteroids and writing an asteroid book. I have the book, and I've been going through it. It's terrific, and I'm really enjoying it. Gordon, welcome to the Space Show this morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell the listeners how you got interested. I guess I would say out of the blue, but since it was early morning and it was still dark, out of the black. How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, fortunately, I'm an early riser. I was up at about 4 o'clock. having a cup of coffee on my back porch in Arizona. This was in June of 2016. And it was completely dark, but all of a sudden there started to be this glow. And it was sort of a red kind of lava-like glow. It was so bright it was casting shadows on the ground and everything. And went on for a few seconds, and then far off to the northeast, there was an explosion of a white light. And I thought, wow, what is this? I mean, it was almost like end-of-the-world stuff. So a little while later, I found out as I was watching the news reports, because this thing made the national news, it turned out it was an asteroid, a very small asteroid, 6 feet, 5 feet, about the size of a Lazy Boy recliner. It had hit the atmosphere at 40,000 miles per hour, and it blazed through the atmosphere and then exploded. And what struck me about that was when they said it was only 5 or 6 feet wide, this piece of space rock, I just couldn't imagine how such a small object could have such power. NASA estimated that it exploded with the force of about 500 kilotons of TNT, which is about 50 times bigger than the largest conventional bomb that the U.S. military has in its arsenal. So I started looking into it, and the more I found, just more fascinated I became as to how these space rocks can pack such power, and how often do they hit Earth, and what's the history of our knowledge of asteroids, and one thing just kind of grew to another.
Did it actually explode over Arizona, or was it someplace else and you just saw the light and heard the explosion?
It was Arizona, and actually a team from ASU, your rivals from when you were back at UA, they sent out a team, and amazingly, this was in very rugged mountainous country. They actually managed to find some very small but still significant meteorites that the explosion of the asteroid had scattered over the ground.
Interesting. So somebody did go out looking for debris from it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, the very small pieces, just very small pieces, but in that kind of environment, that kind of terrain, it was amazing they found anything.
Now, you live in a ancient times, prehistoric, fascinating geologic state, because there's just all sorts of cool stuff that went on in Arizona, all over Arizona, New Mexico, and in parts of Utah. And there are also, I mean, you could go on tours just to see geological things on Earth in that little area there, and you could probably be busy for a year without
sure.
a doubt. But some of the stuff is asteroid oriented, especially meteor craters. So had you been to Meteor Crater before this happened? Had you taken advantage of the Arizona environment, for example?
You know, I had not been to Meteor Crater, but I quickly learned about it, and just hopped in the car and drove up there. It's about 90 miles from where I live in northern Arizona. And for your listeners, who may not be familiar with it, this is a crater. It's about almost a mile wide, about 500 feet deep, that was left by an asteroid impact 50,000 years ago. And to see this thing, and this asteroid that made this crater was only maybe 60, 70 yards wide, something like that. To see the impact, the power that even a small asteroid could exert, and what it could leave behind was breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking.
I know people who fly across the country, if your route goes over that, the pilots usually will tell you can look out the window if it's clear, and you can see it plain as day. I mean,
yeah.
it is really, really huge.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So you got an interest in this. How did your search proceed, or did you initially have in mind writing a book about it, or did you just want to maybe know more about asteroids?
Yeah, it was at first it was just curiosity, because I have to admit that when I started research for my book, I wasn't a trained scientist by any means. I'm kind of embarrassed at the lack of science courses on my college transcripts. But the more I looked at it, just the more fascinated I became, and I started to wonder, how much do we know about these things? How long have we known about these things? And it just it built from there, and everything that I discovered was just fascinating to me. And you know, in a way, David, you probably experience this too. A lot of times, even at a certain age, there's a certain joy in learning new stuff. Especially when the stuff is what scientists call very cool. And again and again, I would come up with information that was just very cool to me. And that's what led to the book.
I have an interesting question for you by email. This is Terry in Denver, and he says, David, I'm at work, so I'm using email. And he says, Mr. Dillo, we in the space community are pretty knowledgeable about asteroids, impacts, NASA and planetary defense, and the threat and the process of identifying asteroids. But you are on the other side in the general public. So I'm curious, before your exposure to this atmospheric explosion, were you aware of anything about asteroid collisions with Earth, NASA's planetary defense and identification program, the threat that existed? I know there have been big-time blockbuster movies about the subject, but do you think you're typical of the general public? Was your knowledge level about the same as the general public, or better or lower than the general public on this topic?
I'd say it was about average, and most of it came, dubiously, from movies like Armageddon and Deep Impact, which were exciting movies. You could run down an entire list of scientific impossibilities, especially in Armageddon. But I would say my knowledge was about asteroids, and that was my interest in writing the book. It wasn't, you know, to write a book for scientists, because they've probably forgotten more about asteroids than I'll ever know. But to get across to the general public, you know, what these things are about, and you know how fascinating they are, and what dangers they pose. And I think in a way for this kind of book, it's sort of an advantage to start from scratch, because you don't have any preconceived notions, and you kind of know what the general reading public doesn't know, because it's stuff that initially you don't know. So you're able to, I think it made me able to get things across in kind of a interesting, non-hyperscience kind of way, so that people could access it, so they could understand it. And, you know, I use a lot of analogies and that sort of thing to explain what near-Earth objects are and that sort of stuff. So, I would say my knowledge was, you know, probably about average. Below average, Terry. Maybe I'm giving myself too much credit.
Did you know about NASA's planetary defense program and asteroid identification and size and threat ID? Did you know about any of that?
You know, I had heard of it, but I hadn't really. I didn't really know how extensive it was and how much progress we've made in the past just a couple of decades. I think what a lot of people may not understand is that 30, 40 years ago, we were only aware of dozens, maybe, of asteroids that actually came within Earth, near-Earth objects, that, although the ones we know about don't pose a threat right now, they could someday. Some of them could someday. But now we've discovered thousands of these things out there. And it's just an amazing level of knowledge, or facet of knowledge, that we've only accumulated in the past 20 or 30 years. So it may take a while for people to kind of catch up. Although now, hardly a day goes by that you won't see a headline, sometimes in tabloids, tabloid websites and that sort of thing. Asteroid, you know, giant asteroid headed towards Earth. Or, you know, asteroid could hit Earth, you know, next September. That sort of thing. And the reason is that we're just seeing more of these things. You know, you'll probably recall just a few days ago, July 25th, there was an asteroid called 2019 OK, which is a nice designation, I guess, that it was about a 300-foot asteroid that flew within 43,000 miles of the Earth. But it wasn't picked up until just a few hours before it passed by. And it missed us by about 43,000 miles, which is good, and, you know, most asteroids do miss us. But when you put that into proportion, an asteroid that misses by 43,000 miles, it's kind of like a bullet passing by your head about 36 inches away. Now, it doesn't kill you, it doesn't hurt you, but if you got any sense at all, it should grab your attention.
Is there a fix for the problem? How does your book deal with the threat and the way to mitigate or reduce the threat?
Well, they're working right now. Serious people are working on this. When I was writing the book, a lot of people, you know, I would tell my friends, oh, I'm writing a book about asteroids, and they'd say, oh, what, you're writing science fiction now? So a lot of people aren't aware of this, but NASA really is. They have a program, it's the Planetary Defense Coordination Office, that is looking at what should we do if we detect an asteroid that has a very high probability of striking Earth. And there's a mission right now called the DART mission, which is supposed to launch in 2021, I believe, and they're going to test an asteroid deflection technique against an actual asteroid. This has never been done before. So, you know, people are taking this seriously.
Are you optimistic that something would be developed in time to stop a big asteroid from coming into Earth?
Well, it kind of depends on what we call big. You know, we think that we've identified most of the near-Earth asteroids that are bigger than half a kilometer, maybe about 90% of them. The problem is that the ones they haven't, because there's so many of them, the ones that they haven't fully, you know, mapped and identified are the ones that are smaller than that, bigger than, say, 140 meters in diameter or width, however you want to express it. And those are the ones that actually pose the most threat to Earth because of their numbers. There's just more of them than there are the big ones. So there's several means they could use to deflect an asteroid. Right now it's theoretical, but with this DART mission that's coming up, they'll be able to test one method that's called kinetic impactors. And basically that's cannonball technology. You send up a spacecraft, you ram it into the asteroid. And the idea isn't to destroy the asteroid or break it into little pieces. It's just to slow it down a little bit. Just the tiniest reduction in its velocity. And the idea is that over millions of miles as it travels through space, that tiny reduction will mean that when it reaches its intended rendezvous point with Earth, Earth will already have passed along on its orbit around the sun, and the thing will miss us.
It's going to be interesting to see how some of these projects work out when they get ready to test them. But in the meantime, your book also does have a probability sort of threat assessment of the likelihood of Earth being hit. So why don't you walk us through that?
Well, yeah, again, it depends on the size. And what I'm sure your listeners know, if an asteroid is small enough, it's going to burn up in the atmosphere. I mean, that's protecting us from asteroid impacts. It's kind of another one of the great things that the atmosphere does for us, so we probably should take better care of it. The probabilities, the scientists go way back and forth on this because, you know, we don't have quite enough historical data. In the past 100 years, a little over 100 years, there have been three pretty significant impacts. There was the Tunguska event back in 1908 in Siberia, in which a 200 to 600 foot asteroid or maybe a piece of a comet exploded in the atmosphere and leveled millions of trees, knocked them down, just, you know, devastated an entire area. There was another incident in Russia in 1947, I believe it was, where, again, it was an asteroid that exploded in the atmosphere. But the most recent one was in 2013, where a relatively small asteroid, maybe 60 feet wide, came into the atmosphere, exploded pretty high up, maybe a few miles, but the shock wave came out, you know, it went out in all directions, and it hit the Russian town of Chelyabinsk, and it blew out thousands and thousands of windows and actually injured about 1,500 people, mostly from flying glass. So we tend to have a short memory. These things happen pretty often. We just kind of tend to forget them.
Another question from you, Sally, also in Denver, Colorado. And she says, lots of people in the space industry propose making sure that we start civilization on Mars or someplace other than Earth so that humans can continue to thrive and exist if they are destroyed by an incoming something or another hitting Earth. Your thoughts on that? Others seem to think it would be better to spend the money trying to figure out how to defend Earth than to try to migrate a handful of people to someplace else.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the best example on that is the asteroid that most scientists agree wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago.
Uh-huh.
Now, that was not a small asteroid. That was about 6 miles wide. And when it hit near the what's now the Yucatan Peninsula, it sent up just an enormous, you know, cloud of, you know, dust and, you know, other materials that circled the Earth, blocked the sun, caused basically an impact winter, and killed off the dinosaurs. Were such a thing to happen today, which is unlikely. I don't want to scare anybody, but that's unlikely. Personally, I think that there would be enough survivalists, preppers, even maybe some government programs to keep a certain percentage of people alive, either through greenhouse agriculture or stored up food and water and that sort of thing. So I don't think that an impact like that, even if it happened today, would wipe out humanity. I'm not saying it would be a great day. It would be the worst day humanity ever experienced. But I think we would survive. So going to Mars as a refuge from something like this, I'm not sure that's really what we're looking at.
You know, sort of unrelated, years ago I used to do shows on what it would take to reboot civilization if something like an asteroid wiped it out. And there's actually a UK scientist who wrote a book on that, and he was a guest on the show. But he asked some pretty thought-provoking questions. So if a handful of people, survivalists and people, survive, could they even recreate extremely basic primitive technology? For example, could they create toilet paper? Could they create a pencil? Could they make a crystal, Cub Scout radio to see if somebody somewhere might be broadcasting a signal? Could someone create a simple transmitter to try to broadcast? Could somebody create power and energy other than through a fire? If you start thinking about just basic things that all of us take for granted, but none of us could probably create or build, rebooting a civilization might be pretty hard, depending on who survived. Even if you survive right next to the public library and you could go in and look up plans on how to make an ever-ready battery, for example, or, something like that, how many people could even follow those plans?
Yeah, yeah. Well, our advantage would be we'd have a lot of spare parts.
Maybe. You're being optimistic. You might, but you have to access those parts and know what they are. That what if you walked into a big Amazon warehouse of spare electrical parts, and they were all coded with their technical names? For someone to really know what to do with that, you'd have to have survivors that had the technical knowledge.
But
what if you're just normal, ordinary people sitting on their back porch drinking coffee? They don't know what all that means.
Yeah, that would be a problem, although I have a generator. Whether I could build a greenhouse and, actually produce enough food to feed myself, I don't know. I don't know. I just think that there's so much knowledge out there. And
Let me ask you a question, because I too have a generator. So after the gasoline or propane is used up, could you convert your generator to work on solar power?
Or grain alcohol. You know, I could grow some corn and make alcohol and run the generator on alcohol.
Okay, so you could distill corn or whatever the right terminology is to get grain alcohol. Not everybody could. You'd have to build some kind of distillery, right, like a bootlegger.
Yeah, it would have the added advantage that I could drink it.
And you might not notice the plight that you're in, right?
Exactly.
You have another email question. I'm with you, by the way. I think it's better to defend Earth and find out a way to make sure this doesn't happen than to do the migration kind of thing, although I totally support space settlement and going to Mars. But
yeah, me too.
I just think that going because you want to be able to start a human race after we're all destroyed here is probably not such a hot reason to do it. So this is from Doug, who's in Southern California. And he says, "Hi, Gordon. We have made good progress in recent years detecting more and more near-Earth asteroids. The telescopes are also able to detect smaller and smaller asteroids. So do you think that if there was a near-Earth asteroid that was large enough to cause human extinction, that we should have already detected something that large? In other words, do you think that we are safe from an extinction-level impact, at least from the near-Earth population?"
One thing I learned is that space is full of surprises. And astronomers and scientists in general, they're kind of loath to ever say never. But I think it's a small chance that they wouldn't pick up an Earth-destroying size asteroid. The problem is, what do we do about it? Right now, they think, well, we might be able to handle something maybe about a half a kilometer wide, a kilometer wide, something like that, in terms of diverting it to where it missed Earth. Bigger than that, they just aren't sure. We don't know enough about their composition and how they would react to different diversion methods and that sort of stuff. And that's what that NASA DART project is. It's a first step. It's kind of a baby first step, but it's a first step in figuring that out. So I think right now we're in a window where if we keep on working on it and if we keep on funding planetary defense, that 30, 40 years from now, we'll have a much better grasp on what to do. Right now, it's all theoretical. A lot of it would depend on how much advance warning we got. If, like the one that passed by us on July 25th, which wasn't a world ender in any sense, it could have caused extensive regional impacts or effects. But it certainly wouldn't have wiped out civilization, but if a 6-miler or a 2-miler or something like that was on our way, and we had, 10 years, 20 years of advance warning, then I like to think, and call me an optimist, but I like to think we might be able to come up with a way to just nudge that thing, off its course just enough to where it missed her. Maybe I'm being too optimistic.
I've always heard it's a factor of how much time before it hits. So the further out, the better chance we can deal with it. The closer in, we don't have such a hot chance of dealing with
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Exactly.
So hopefully if one has Earth written on it, that it's can be detected many, many years or decades before it gets this close.
And the problem is that, say we do pick up an asteroid that has... And when they first spot an asteroid, the guys at the Center for Near Earth Object Studies at JPL, they'll assign a probability of whether it's going to impact Earth. And usually it's less than 1% or 0 or whatever it is. But suppose they give it a 1% probability of hitting Earth in 20 years. Now, are the politicians going to say, "Oh, okay, we better have a crash program"? To try to deflect an asteroid that has a 1 in 100 chance of hitting us long after I'm out of political office. So as the asteroid, makes more revolutions, around the sun, and they get more observations, they can start to narrow it down. They can say, okay, well, now we've had a bunch of observations. and it's going to be a 50% chance. Well, then we're more likely to mobilize the resources needed, you know, to start designing and building, you know, some sort of mission that would deflect it. So the politics comes into this as well. You know, it's not just a science question, it's a political question.
My hunch is they'd find a way to kick it down the road.
Yeah.
But, which is, you know, what Congress is famous for doing. But who really knows? Are you of the thought that it's inevitable that the Earth is going to get hit by a big asteroid sometime in the future, whatever that future may be?
Sure.
It's inevitable that it's going to happen again?
It is absolutely inevitable. I mean, yeah, I think the best way for people to visualize how many impacts Earth has experienced in its 4.5 billion year history is to go out back on a nice clear night when there's a full moon, and with a telescope or even a good pair of binoculars, and look up at the moon. And all those craters, and remember, these are just the ones you can see. You can't see the smaller ones from here with a small telescope. But all those craters represent an impact, because obviously the moon has no atmosphere, so everything that comes its way, boom, it hits the surface. So the reason Earth doesn't look like that is the craters that have hit us, and there have been billions of them over the 4.5 billion year history of Earth that have actually hit us. You know, on Earth, erosion and glaciation and that sort of thing, it covers them up. The only reason Meteor Crater is still there is because it's, in geological terms, it's pretty young, just 50,000 years. But when you, and also smaller ones, as we talked about earlier, smaller asteroids burn up in the atmosphere and don't leave a crater. But when you look at the moon, which has no erosion and no atmosphere, you can see that thing is just covered with not just thousands, but hundreds of thousands, millions of craters of all sizes, from little tiny ones to great big ones that stretch 600 miles across. So if the moon's getting hit by these things, it means that Earth is too. And so the chances that we're going to get hit again, it's a lead pipe cinch. It's one in one. It's 100%. You know, is it going to be next Tuesday? Maybe not. Probably not. Is it going to be 100 years from now? You know, still likely. It's still possible. Is it going to be within a million years? I would say absolutely.
Another email. Alan is in Dallas, and Alan says, maybe I've seen too many movies, but if a large damaging asteroid was close enough to Earth to do a lot of damage and was discovered with a short time frame, do you think governments would tell the people?
I don't think they'd be able to not tell the people. And I kind of went into this in the book that, you know, in the movies Armageddon and Deep Impact, they all, the government's kind of kept it a secret, you know, while they designed and built these hugely expensive diversion missions or destruction missions. And the problem is that, again, once somebody spots an asteroid, they can't really say, okay, it's definitely going to hit us. They need follow-up observations from around the world, you know, some by professional astronomers, you know, working, you know, at various observatories, sometimes by just, you know, sophisticated but still amateur backyard astronomers. And so they need all these observations to really refine the asteroid's orbit and decide, okay, yeah, this one's going to hit us. Now, when you have people doing like that internationally, and, you know, as much as I love astronomers, when it comes to their professional work, they're notorious blabbermouths. They love to talk about their work. And, you know, with email and, you know, all the social media and that sort of stuff, I just don't think the government could keep it quiet for more than maybe 30 minutes.
So you think the people would find out?
Yeah, I think that, excuse me, Dave. Yes, I think they would find out because, I mean, what would be the outcome if FEMA and you know, the U.S. government had known for a year that there was an asteroid coming that, you know, had the possibility of hitting Denver, say. And then, you know, the asteroid, you know, comes in and hits Denver, and it turns out, oh, we knew about this all along, we just didn't tell anybody. I mean, there would have to be evacuation plans or diversion plans to see if it would work, evacuation plans if it didn't. And I just don't see how they could get away with it. Now, again, maybe I'm being too naive or, you know, or something, but I just don't see how that would work.
June is in Portland, Oregon, and she said, I don't think this is necessarily related to your book, but it is related to asteroids. There seems to be a lot of interest and potential to make money off of asteroids, to commercially mine them. There was even a program of some sort to bring one in to orbit around the moon during the Obama administration to learn how to do that, plus to do other things with an asteroid. How do you see asteroids as a commercial value rather than just a threat to Earth?
Well, I think in the future there is going to be a tremendous private enterprise effort in space. You know, one thing I got into the book was that on Meteor Crater, that was actually the first effort to mine an asteroid. There was a very wealthy mining engineer named Daniel Berenger, who in the early 1900s saw Meteor Crater and found out that some of the meteorites that had broken off and were still left, they were metallic. They had iron, nickel, platinum, iridium, and so he launched a scheme, and he spent the next 20 years doing this, and most of his personal fortune, trying to dig up that asteroid and sell the metallic products, the precious metals, the platinum, and the iridium. Well, it turned out that the asteroid that created Meteor Crater had basically vaporized on impact. They didn't know this at the time. They didn't understand how kinetic energy really worked. But he tried it, you know, and was hoping to get rich on it. So the idea of making money off asteroids goes way back. And I'm convinced that eventually they'll be able to, you know, mine asteroids in the future. Now, the idea that they're going to go up to an asteroid and mine out its platinum and gold and iridium and that sort of thing and then bring it back to Earth, that's not really feasible, because what if you discover an asteroid that's got, you know, a million tons of platinum? Well, you couldn't bring that all back to Earth, because then platinum wouldn't be worth anything on Earth. So the main benefit of mining asteroids in space is to create products in space. You can take water out of asteroids that can be used to make space fuel. Or you could take the iron and the nickel and use them to build space stations out in space, or even space colonies. So yeah, I'm convinced that someday there's going to be a commercial aspect to asteroid exploration.
You have a chapter toward the end of your book called Asteroid Wars. So if somebody is thumbing through your book in Barnes & Noble and they see Asteroid Wars, they might be scratching their head. So tell us what you mean by Asteroid Wars.
Well, it's not war between asteroids.
Well, that's what I'm thinking they may be thinking, you know, as they're looking at between the stacks at Barnes & Noble. What the hell? How are the asteroids going to fight each other?
Uh-huh. Well, what that refers to is that, again, and it's a measure of how serious science is taking this now, that every couple years there's a planetary defense conference, which NASA participates and other you know, European Space Agency and, you know, other national space programs. And a couple hundred scientists get together, and they ponder that very question. Okay, we've spotted an asteroid that's coming towards us. What do we do now? And then to do that, they do the same thing the military does. If they're trying to figure out, okay, suddenly we're at war with France. Now, why we would be at war with France, I don't know. But if we were, here's what we would do, A, B, C, D, and they go down the line. And it's the same thing with these conferences. They do an asteroid war game where they set up a situation and decide, okay, if this is what's facing us, what do we do? And on the most recent Planetary Defense Conference, which was held outside of Washington, D.C. in May, the scenario was that they picked up an asteroid, it was coming towards us, and it was going to hit Denver in 6, 7, 8 years, something like that. So what do we do? So what they did, theoretically, and again, this is just part of the game, they sent up a fleet of kinetic impactors, which we talked about before, the cannonball technology, where you run the spaceship into the asteroid, try to slow it down a little bit. And it worked, sort of. Three of the six kinetic impactors they sent up in this war game worked, and they actually, you know, hit the asteroid and diverted it enough to where it just barely missed Earth. Unfortunately, a 200-foot chunk of the 800-foot asteroid broke off. And that piece of asteroid was now on a collision course to hit New York City. Okay. So they figure, oh my gosh, what are we going to do now? And the idea was to send up a nuclear explosive device to destroy it, but there just wasn't time. They only had 6 months. So unfortunately, it was goodbye Manhattan. Denver was saved, but they managed to destroy Manhattan. So, you know, and they learn from these things. They learn, okay, we did this and it didn't work. So next time, if it actually turns out to be real, let's try this and see if that works. So that's what I mean by asteroid war games.
When you were being a military correspondent, did you ever cover any of the famous war games that are held each year?
You know, I was more at the junior level on that. I was over in Iraq several times, embedded with Marine infantry units at about the company level, which is, you know, a couple hundred guys. So I didn't deal with the big picture in that so much. But I was in the military myself, so I'm familiar with how they do it. And you can bet that in the Pentagon somewhere, there's a in a sense, a war game or a war plan for, you know, if we wind up in a war with Canada, or we wind up in a war with, you know, the Netherlands. I mean, you know, they do these regularly, so, you know, it's not an unusual thing.
Did you attend any of these? Well, I don't know if you would have been able to attend one of these conferences where they have these war game scenarios for planetary defense. Have you ever done that, or is that even available for an outsider to attend?
You know, sadly, my timing was bad because the first one after I started the book was in 2017, which was the first one, but it was the first one I could have gone to. Was in 2017, which was just before I started working on the book. And then the next one was in 2019, which was just after, you know, I had to turn the book in. So I did follow the 2019 conference online, though. They live streamed it, and so I watched all the entire week.
Did you learn anything from it?
Always learn something from these things, David. You know, I think the main thing that I learned, and that most of the scientists who were there learned, unintended consequences. We just don't know enough about asteroids now to know if we hit them with a kinetic impactor, what's going to happen. Things can go wrong. And you learn more from things that go wrong in these exercises than you learn from things that go right.
Another question for you from a listener. Paul is in Berkeley, California, and he says about a year ago, David did shows with scientists who were wanting to use nuclear bombs to dislodge or move or push an asteroid slightly. Did you come across those kinds of theories? I forget what they're called, but his guess was from Lawrence Livermore National Lab.
The problem is that a lot of scientists think that a nuclear explosive device, or a NED, they hesitate to call them bombs, is probably the most efficient means to use to deflect an asteroid. And again, the idea wouldn't be like blowing up the asteroid like Bruce Willis did in Armageddon. It would be to park a nuclear device just maybe 50, 100 meters away from the incoming asteroid, detonate the explosive device, and that would cause enough of a nudge to the asteroid to, over the course of millions of miles, it would miss Earth. The problem is that there's a number of, at least a couple scientific, international scientific treaties that prohibit the use of nuclear weapons in space, or even the introduction of nuclear weapons in space. So you'd have to get around that somehow. You know, people just get squeamish about the use of nuclear weapons, even in space, even for nuclear detonation that would occur tens of millions of miles away from Earth. They're just worried about it. So, you know, I think if we were in a situation where an asteroid was, where an impending impact was certain, there was no question that it was going to come down, it was going to hit a populated area, I think that probably most people would get on board with using a nuclear explosive device to do something about it. The problem is, would we have enough time to design such a mission to do it? You couldn't just use the regular ICBMs that we have now, because they aren't designed to hit something out in space, you know. And if you waited until the asteroid actually was, you know, in or near the atmosphere, you would just make the problem, if you blew it up, you just make the problem worse. You would turn one relatively big asteroid into a bunch of relatively small asteroids that could cause more destruction than the big one. So it's kind of a difficult question, Paul.
I think I did two shows last year with people from Lawrence Livermore Lab, or maybe one was in 2017, one was in 2018. So, first of all, they did not want to talk about our portfolio of hydrogen bombs, okay? So, and I was saying, do we have the weapons, because I don't know what else to call them, or do we have the H-bombs or the thermonuclear bombs that can do this? And they don't want to talk about that part of this at all. So, and then how big would it have to be? And would you have to customize an H-bomb to do this? And the most I could get out of them, and both of them were pretty tight-lipped, and I guess they all have security clearances, and I don't blame them, but they said is there is no problem using our current inventory and stockpile of nuclear devices to do this for planetary defense. That was the most of a kind of statement I could get from them.
Yeah.
Nothing about the delivery system, the missile, the this or the that. They didn't go down that road at all. They just talked about 1,500 yards away or meters away, and we have the equipment to do it, but they sure don't want to talk about it.
Well, we certainly have the equipment to do it, and actually, from what I've read, I don't have a classification. I don't have classified information, so, you know. If the NIS is listening, you know, I'm not saying anything that I'm giving away any secrets. But it appears that for a smaller asteroid, you could probably use a really kind of a small nuclear weapon. Maybe, you know, even in the kiloton range as opposed to the megaton range. I think the average nuclear warhead that we have now is about 2-3 megatons. Something like that of the bigger ones. The biggest nuclear weapon ever detonated was La Bamba.
Well, that was the Russian one.
The Russian Tsar Bamba, which was about 50 megatons. So we don't have anything even approaching that. Maybe our biggest one now is maybe 25 megatons, but there's plenty of smaller ones that we could use as well.
Well, and Russia, if they participated in planetary defense, also has a stockpile of these things. So, interesting. Listeners, we still have time if you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. And there is still time for those of you who have been using email if you want to continue doing so. Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. For interested people wanting to know more about this or to nudge their government to be more active, perhaps, or something like that, is there a methodology behind accomplishing that kind of pressure or citizen interest that may mean something? Like, is there a congressional committee that specifically deals with this, or members of Congress that have a special interest in this that you found out about?
Yeah, there's a committee. I can't remember the exact title, but it's on technology and space. I hate to say, oh, write your congressman, but it couldn't hurt. And you know, part of the problem with planetary defense is that the amount we've been spending on it has been going steadily up. In 2019, it's about $150 million. But that's still only less than 1% of NASA's overall budget of somewhere around $20 billion. And when you compare $150 million on planetary defense compared to the $700 billion that we're spending on conventional defense forces, it's less than a drop in the bucket. Now, I'm all for national defense, but planetary defense is national defense.
But it's under NASA.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not under DOD.
It's not under DOD. It's under NASA. So, it's a separate thing, but I was just trying to, make a comparison in the amount. $150 million is a lot of money, but in the context of the federal government, it's not a lot of money.
Another question, maybe, unless some more keep coming in, this maybe will be the last one. So, Karen is in Atlanta. And she said earlier in the show, Gordon, you listed a couple of events that have impacted us here on Earth over history. Do you think that the people in charge of defending Earth for asteroids, the policymakers, the leaders, the scientists, all of them, are they learning lessons from the past, and are they learning the appropriate lessons at the appropriate speed?
I believe they are. I mean, they studied these things extensively. And I really admire these people, because what they're doing in terms of locating, asteroids, potentially dangerous asteroids, to me it's sort of like the mariners and the explorers of the 17th and 18th century who were mapping all the reefs and shoals in the world's ocean. And, they assembled maps, what we'd call a database today, so that the mariners and explorers who came after them could avoid those reefs and shoals and not run into them and drown. And that's what the planetary defense community is doing right now. It's assembling a catalog, a database, of these asteroids that someday could pose a threat to Earth. Maybe not next week or even the next decade, but maybe in our great-grandchildren's time. Because they'll be able to look and they'll say, okay, well, this asteroid, it missed us when it came by, in 2019, but it's got a certain percent of a chance, based on the calculations, to come really close in the year 2119. So I really admire these people, and I think they're doing the best they can. I wish there were more of them out there.
How do we get your book? It was published in June of this year, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the usual places?
A fine bookstore near you. If they don't have it, they'll order it for you. Certainly available on Amazon, and I hope people will pick it up.
Is it a Kindle book, too?
Yes, and an audio book as well.
Oh, who does the reading of it, you?
Well, no, it wasn't me. I guess they decided to go with a professional, not Dave.
Do they abridge it when they do the audio book, or is it the full book?
It's the whole book. So, however, people want to hear it. And I think what I'd like to say is that you don't have to worry that you're going to get bogged down in a lot of scientific terms. I mean, there are scientific terms, but it's written for people who are not well-versed in the subject.
So it's written for the public, not necessarily a sophisticated space audience who deals with this all the time.
And what I tried to get into is the human stories behind it. The man I mentioned earlier, Daniel Berenger, trying to dig up the asteroid, and a scientist named Gene Shoemaker, who was the first one to kind of warn us about, this impending threat from asteroids. And, some of the people who were actually involved in it. I spent an evening up at the top of, with the Catalina Sky Survey, on top of Mount Lemmon outside of
Tucson,
which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah.
With a guy named an asteroid hunter named Richard Kowalski, and watched as he went through, you know, scanning the skies and looking for asteroids that someday could pose a threat. So it's about people. It's not just about science.
What does an asteroid hunter do?
Well, they scan the sky. They look for basically anomalies among the stars out there. If they spot a bright light, or even a not so bright light that seems to be moving against the background of fixed stars, they can say, "Oh, well, that's an asteroid." And you know, what's amazing to me is that most asteroids, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, are in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter.
Right.
And we've discovered just in the past 20 years, something three-quarters of a million, most of the large asteroids, you know, in the asteroid belt. But the ones we have to worry about, I kind of liken it to a NASCAR racetrack. The asteroid belt is, the asteroids are like NASCAR cars, are going around and around and around the track, you know. And as long as they stay in their own lane, stay on the track, everything is fine. But every now and then, one of them sort of veers off the track and starts cutting donuts in the infield. And the sun and Earth are in the infield. So those are the ones we have to worry about, the ones that have kind of veered off their usual orbit and are coming close to us. And there's thousands of them out there. So without alarming anybody, someday one of them is going to plow into us. It's happened millions of times in the past. It's going to happen in the future.
I have one email question that got in on the 11th hour, so I'm going to ask it. This is from David in Memphis. And David said, I don't have your book, but it sounds like a great read, also one that would educate my teenage boys on the subject. My question is, it seems to me that since we're talking about really horribly damaging events, at least for the United States, but elsewhere too, that FEMA ought to be involved in this process. But I haven't heard you mention that. I don't know if FEMA is part of your book or is part of the process for planetary defense. Is this also a FEMA project?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The planetary defense conferences that I mentioned, where they do the asteroid war games, you know, and run out these scenarios, FEMA is very much involved in this. In fact, FEMA and NASA sometimes do just their own, you know, for people, emergency, you know, response officials and that sort of thing, and do the similar thing. You know, okay, what if an asteroid, you know, were to hit Houston, Texas, something like that? So yeah, it's very much a FEMA program. They have pretty extensive. Now, for FEMA, their role would not be the diversion of the asteroid. It would be planning what to do if we couldn't divert it, if an asteroid actually was going to hit a populated area. And so that's where their part of the planning comes in. And it's sort of unusual for FEMA because this an asteroid impact is something that could be predicted years in advance. I mean, with a hurricane, you can predict it, a week?
Right,
earthquakes,
yeah.
Earthquakes, you can hardly predict it at all. Wildfires, the same thing. But this would actually involve a bunch of unique circumstances, because what do you do when you have to come out and say, well, Houston, Texas, you're about to get hit by an asteroid. You know, what's that going to do for property values and economic values? And how do you evacuate people? And some people aren't going to want to leave. And so FEMA goes through this pretty extensively.
So is that in your book too, by the way?
Yes. I discuss this at pretty much length.
Gordon, fascinating book, a great subject. Listeners, even if you think you may be really up on the subject, I promise you, you'll learn a lot of new things. And if you have family members or friends that are clueless, like most of us do, this is really a good introduction, and will give them a lot of expertise to continue their education and their concern about this problem. So I really recommend it, Fire in the Sky, Cosmic Collisions, Killer Asteroids, and The Race to Defend Earth. Remember, if you use Amazon and you get it through Amazon and you use one of the space shell portals, then Amazon donates a percentage of the purchase price back to the space show. Do you have a book website? Do you have autographed copies?
Well, I have a website. It's pretty simple, www.gordondillo.com.
Okay.
You can just Google my name and the word asteroids, and it will come up.
Okay. Is there a way for people to get autographed copies if they're interested?
Well, you know, they can send it to me, and I'd happily sign it for them.
Okay.
They can contact me by email at gordondillo@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to either answer any questions they have or, discuss getting them a signed copy.
Okay. Do you have a sequel to this book? Are you continuing your exploration of the topic, or what's next for you?
Well, you know, I keep following it. I check various websites every day, and just to see what's new, because I'm fascinated. I'm not sure whether I'll have a follow-up book on this or not, or maybe some other scientific subject that interests me.
Keep us posted, okay?
I sure will, David.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate it. Listeners, again, I recommend his book. And thank you for your emails, everybody. And Gordon, thank you, and a great book. Have a great weekend. And listeners, keep looking up. Maybe you'll see the next asteroid approaching Earth. So you look for something moving against a star on a dark sky. Maybe you'll see one. Let us know. Everybody, again, enjoy the upcoming weekend. Goodbye from Gordon, David, and the Space Show.